Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Patentability of DNA Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 13, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Association for Molecular Pathology v. Myriad Genetics, Incorporated. The issue in the case was whether human genes are patentable. In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court held by a vote of 9-0 that a naturally occurring DNA segment is not patentable merely because it has been isolated, but that complementary DNA, which is synthetic and does not occur in nature, is patent eligible. Justice Scalia filed an opinion concurring in part and in the judgment. To discuss the case, we have Gregory Dolan, who is Associate Professor and Co-Director of the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Dolan.
Last Thursday, the Supreme Court issued its long-awaited decision in Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. In that case, the question presented sounded simple. It read, are human genes patentable? Unfortunately, the question presented did not reflect the true dispute between the parties. The true dispute between the parties actually centered not on human genes as we generally think of them, as genes carried in a body of every individual, but whether molecules isolated from those genes that are carried by every individual are in fact patent eligible. And in order to understand the difference, one must understand a little bit the basic primer of genetics. In human body, DNA is generally packed into chromosomes, and we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Each chromosome may carry thousands of genes, each of those genes being responsible for a particular trait or characteristics or ability to either fight off or contract a disease. The problem is that nobody knows where each particular gene starts and the next and stops and the next one starts and stops. In fact, the problem may be compounded by the fact that sometimes genes overlap. And so when the body reads them, those genes, the body itself figures out where to start the reading process. Making the problem even more complicated is that within those genes, there are regions that actually code for ultimate product, the protein, and regions that do not code for anything. So the fundamental problem facing medical geneticists is figuring out where in that chromosome that may carry up to 20,000 genes each, where does a particular gene start and stops? And so ultimately what isolating DNA is creating tools for research and future diagnostics. It is not merely figuring out what long sequence people have inside their bodies. And these tools, these isolated DNA molecules, once the geneticists figure out where each gene starts and stops and then isolate it from the chromosome, these tools actually do not exist in nature because, again, in nature they're packed oftentimes 20,000 at a time into each chromosome, although it is true that these tools do mimic, in fact, what naturally occurs. So what naturally occurs in the body is known as the central dogma of genetics. The DNA carries instructions for cells how to create proteins and ultimately for each cell how to function, which is why our brain cells function one way and our liver cells function another way, because the DNA, even though it's identical in each of those cells, is expressed differentially depending on the cell type. So each DNA molecule carries information to each cell as to how to function and what to do. The challenges ultimately to Myriad's patents ultimately focused not so much on the chemical nature of these tools, but on this very informational nature. And the Supreme Court actually ended up, at least in part, buying the challenger's argument. The court actually concluded that if the information carrying function is the same in the isolated tool and naturally occurring chromosome, and the modification from the chromosome to the tool was minimal, there's no patent eligibility. And this is somewhat of a unique decision, precisely because usually when dealing with chemical substances, the court focuses on the chemical structure, and they ask whether a particular chemical does or does not exist in nature, and if it does not, then it's something necessarily created by humans in the laboratory, and that is pretty much the end of patentability inquiry, and the chemical is in fact patent eligible. But here the court focused on the information carrying capacity of DNA, under this theory that DNA is somehow unique because of the central dogma, because the DNA controls all the downstream function of the cells. It carries this informational functions for cells how to function. The problem with that approach is that it is erroneous to think that DNA is somehow unique. In fact, informational nature of DNA is not at all unique. It is we tend to think of it as such, but it actually is not. For example, proteins, through their shape and binding abilities, also carry information. For example, a particular protein binding to a particular receptor may set off as a whole chain reaction inside the cell, causing the cell to function one way or another. And that happens only because of the particular three-dimensional structure of the protein. And even though we generally don't think of proteins as information-carrying molecules, we simply think of them as chemicals. In fact, if one takes a step back, one understands that there's really little difference between proteins and DNA in terms of informational nature. So it's a fallacy that DNA is unique in this regard. However, the court did agree with the petitioners that DNA is somewhat unique and DNA is about information and not so much about chemistry, and concluded that if all that the researcher does is takes a chromosome and simply excises a piece of DNA out of it, after figuring out that this particular piece of DNA is valuable for whatever reason, because it codes for a particular protein or it serves as a marker to certain disease, that in and of itself is not sufficient to change what otherwise would be a product of nature, because chromosomes are in fact a product of nature, into a patentable subject matter. So it's simply taking a small piece out of a bigger piece that exists in nature is not enough. On the other hand, the court did give a victory to biotechnology industry on the second type of tools that geneticists use, and that tool is called cDNA. As I mentioned previously, naturally occurring DNA, native DNA, DNA in chromosomes, has both coding and non-coding regions. cDNA is a laboratory-made construct, and I will not go into details exactly how it's made, but it's a laboratory-made construct that excludes all the non-coding regions. All that is present in cDNA are coding regions only. As a result, cDNA does have the same function in terms of expressing, in terms of creating the same protein down the line, because only non-coding regions are excised. But it is very chemically different, and it does take a lot of human intervention to go from naturally occurring DNA into cDNA. And so the court said that because, even though that information carrying capacity is the same, because of the sufficient human intervention, cDNA, unlike merely isolated DNA, is in fact patent eligible. So in that sense, the court somewhat split the baby. The problem with the court's opinion a bit is that it does tend to jump back and forth between relying on the information carrying capacity of DNA, which they use to hold that isolated DNA is not patent eligible, and the chemical structure of cDNA, which they say is sufficient to make cDNA patent eligible. There's an inconsistency in the opinion as to which feature of the molecule they tend to rely on. Ultimately, though, I think this opinion is not a huge blow to biotech industry, precisely because most of the current advances in biotechnology are beyond working with merely isolated DNA. Myriad's patents are old. They are about to expire. They would have expired anyway, had the court ruled in a different fashion. And so biotechnology has moved somewhat beyond isolated DNA, and so those patents are no longer as valuable as they were back when they were granted to Myriad and similar companies. So in that sense, even though the court invalidated patents granted on isolated DNA, that probably is not particularly worrisome proposition, simply because those patents, to the extent that people have them, are about to expire anyway, and the science has moved beyond that. Where, in court's opinion, might present a problem, though, is that it might be ultimately misinterpreted, especially if read broadly and together with the previous term decision in Mayer versus Prometheus. It remains to be seen whether lower courts will require, in addition to requiring the showing that the product sought to be patented is not a product of nature, that there's a sufficient level of human intervention involved. In other words, will the courts require, at this first step of analysis of eligibility, not ultimately whether the patent should issue, whether the invention is in fact novel, whether the courts will require at this first step of analysis the patentee or the applicant to show both non-natural occurring, the fact that his proposed invention is not naturally occurring, and that there was some sort of sufficient inventive activity happening, which is a very malleable standard. So in summary, I think that this opinion could have been much worse for biotechnology industry. I think that in a lot of ways, biotechnology industry can breathe a sigh of relief because the court did not go as far as petitioners asked them to go to declare all DNA in whatever form to be non-patent eligible, except perhaps DNA that codes only for things that actually don't exist in nature, i.e. Something that's completely made up in the lab. The court did not take that position. The court said that if you sufficiently modify it, even though ultimately the end product, the protein, is the same, DNA may be patent eligible. But the application of this decision may present challenges down the road. And it remains to be seen how it will be applied both in the lab, how will some scientists read it in terms of what they will invest their money in and in their time in, and how it will be applied in the courtroom in terms of how will lower-level courts read this decision, as well as Mayo and the decision that came out a few years ago called Bilski. So in some ways, I'm moderately optimistic. I think it could have been better. I think the court was a little bit confused about the uniqueness of DNA. But ultimately, I think that the court, to the extent they did damage to the biotechnology industry, it was sufficiently minimal.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.